Tim, good morning.
Thank you. I'm Tim Pitts, and I'm the owner of Think Real Estate. It's a residential brokerage on the east side, and I'm here on behalf of many of my colleagues there and throughout the real estate industry in Portland. The past couple of years have been scary, frankly, for us. We've seen rents and prices skyrocketing, houses are being demolished, and a lot of us have a lot of concerns about the direction of the city, and I think that the demolition tax would really address a lot of these issues. My two biggest concerns are that we have an extreme lack of affordable housing and that we're allowing too many of our historic structures to be torn down. So I really think we're fooling ourselves in thinking that we're building a better city by letting so many historic homes be torn down throughout the city. I think there should be stricter regulations, and in cases where someone wants to demolish a functional structure, they should pay a large fee. Builders are claiming, I guess, that the houses being torn down are not houses that anyone would want to live in. But I see many houses come on the market and sell only to be torn down, and in almost every case, these are houses that could have been remodeled and could have been lived in by future residents. I've remodeled houses myself. The first house I bought in Portland was a former drug house off North Mississippi, and it was in terrible condition. And we could have torn it down, but we renovated it and kept it as a historic structure in that neighborhood, and I'm glad that we did. I think many, many of the houses, as I've said, that are being torn down certainly could be inhabited by future people. And clients would rather have these vintage homes. So a lot of my clients want new construction for one reason or another, but the vast majority of Portlanders want to live in vintage structures. Sadly, the way the market is, buyers can't compete with builders for these houses. Time and time again, buyers get beat out by builders that can offer cash, quick close, and people that want to buy a small, modest house with all the money that they have and fix it up over time, they're simply beaten out because the seller wants the best deal possible or they want the most sure thing possible, and so they go with the builder who can say cash, no contingencies, knowing full well that they're just going to tear it down. So I think that a $25,000 tax, while it might not totally prevent that, would level the playing field a little bit and allow homeowners or potential homeowners to actually get into houses that are affordable and in scale with the neighborhood. I know builders also say that the old houses are inefficient in terms of energy usage, but when you look at the fact that they're often tearing down a modest, appropriately sized house and building a monster house in its place, you really lose the efficiencies. You can't tell me that it's good for the environment to tear down a perfectly functional house and put the entire house in the landfill. We're not talking about deconstruction. Nobody's deconstructing houses right now. They're just knocking everything down into a pile of rubble and putting it in the landfill and building a big energy-efficient house that sells for often well above $500,000. So $500,000 is some measure of a transfer tax would be crazy at this point, because $500,000 is quickly becoming the new entry point for a modest bungalow in Portland. So I think that we really do need stricter controls for demolishing houses. We need affordable housing. Rents are going crazy. People are not going to stop moving here. Rents are going to continue to accelerate. Prices are going to continue to accelerate. And if we don't do something, then quickly, people are not going to be able to afford to live in the city that they've lived in. So affordable housing definitely needs attention. And this, to me, seems like a very neat, tidy way to address these two issues. Quickly, regarding the one amendment about homeowners being able to tear down their own house, I know that it's tempting to say that you want to have exemptions so you're not punishing people that actually own their house. But often builders are buying houses off market. And so if you have a provision where if the homeowner applies, they don't have to pay the fee, there's nothing that's going to stop builders from partnering with homeowners under a contract, tearing down the house, building a new house, and then the homeowner is the one selling it and paying a huge profit to the builder as a partnership, but they're going to avoid the $25,000 tax. So I think that if you have some provision like that, I would strongly encourage you to have a 3 to 5 year period where the homeowner has to inhabit it to eliminate that scenario from happening, which is a little bit harder. You put a lien on the property, something like that, but I think that would be very necessary because that would be a super easy loophole to exploit.
Thank you. Helpful. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Fred Leeson at Bosco Milligan Foundation. We own and operate the Architectural Heritage Center at 701 Southeast Grand. We strongly support the idea of the tax. We believe that it will help maybe in some cases tilt a homeowner or developer towards renovation rather than demolition. You actually get a better bang for your buck economically rehabbing a house than you do starting over. We are grateful to the mayor's office for proposing that the density exemption be removed. That had the capacity to gobble up the whole thing. A couple ideas we had is that the fee should be levied on the tax lot, not just a house. If there's a situation where there are more than one tax lot involved, that's going to be one house. That does happen in some neighborhoods. We also like the idea and would suggest that the revenue generated, because it's coming from single-family neighborhoods, should be limited to programs and rehab opportunities in single-family neighborhoods. Just something to think about. Commissioner Novick, I'm concerned about the tiered tax because we know dastardly developer will game the system. They gamed the system back when we had the K-1 exemption where they would buy a home on a double lot, come in and get the automatic permit for one house, build that house, then divide the lot and build the second house. So you got two for one, and they had eliminated the delays. I say that in criticism, but it's also extremely human to try to game the system, and people will game systems. We firmly believe that the most affordable house is the house that's already there. If you're looking for affordable transportation, you don't go to the new car showroom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Okay, let's move to the sign-up sheet, please, and take public testimony from others who are here.
We have 14 people signed up. Would Clinton Wood, Gary Whitehill Basiuk, and John Materneski please come up? They'll be followed by Terry Parker, Steve Smessler, and Lightning.
Good morning. Yeah, if we could hold the testimony to 2 minutes, that'd be helpful because we got a lot of people signed up, but try to be brief. Good morning.
All right. So, my name is Clinton Wood. I actually work at ESCO Corporation as an engineer, and my husband and I adopted a 2-year-old, and we live in Gresham, Oregon, and hope to expand our family. The number one reason why we haven't moved to Portland is not affordability. It's actually suitable family housing. There is just simply a lack of suitable family housing that meets our needs and a lot of family needs. The city's grown over 200,000 people in the last 50 years. And in that same time, there's 30,000 less school-aged children in the city. And we're moving out to the suburbs not because it's too expensive in the city. We're moving out there because the housing needs in the suburbs meet our needs. This new construction that everybody thinks is a monstrosity meets our needs. It accommodates larger families. They attract families with children, which can, in turn, provide more children to attend public schools. They generate higher property taxes for the city than the existing home that's on there. That's capped by Measure 5. To provide a safer and healthier environment that these people here even admit that they're full of asbestos, lead, radon gas leaking into the basement, and dumping stormwater into the city sewer system. They're also more energy efficient. Tearing down homes and gutting them, it just fills up the landfill just as much as tearing down a house. You call these eyesores, but you have no problem building up apartments and low-income housing in the name of affordability. These demo fees only are going to increase the cost for my family to move into the city. It's not making it affordable for anybody. I'm going to come in and buy a lower-cost housing and displace somebody with less, lower income out of the city anyway, and you didn't solve anything. I don't know. Is that beep meaning that's the 2 minutes?
It means you got about 30 seconds.
Okay. So what I'm trying to get at is you guys need to attract families like me. And the housing that's out there simply is not suitable or meeting a lot of the family needs. This new housing is. You guys have a lot of social programs that you want to fund, and you should be funding it through higher property taxes that this new construction pays for. All right. I guess so.
Thank you very much. Okay. Morning.
Hi, my name is Gary Whitehill Basiuk, and I've been a real estate broker in the city for over 25 years. I'm here today speaking on behalf of a number of my clients as well as several of my colleagues. We find this proposal to eliminate the exemption for multiple units a disservice to the city. We currently have a housing shortage. A balanced real estate market is one in which there exists a 6-month inventory of homes on the market. We currently have less than 2. This proposal will only add to this imbalance, thereby making housing even less affordable. We have 2 large groups of people who are either in the current market pool for homes or are about to enter that pool. I speak of the millennials who won't be content living in their 600-square-foot studios on Division forever. They will be looking for affordable homes, hopefully in the city. I say hopefully because if we don't fill that supply side of the equation, I suppose they'll be looking in Gresham or Hillsboro or Milwaukee. The other large group is the baby boomers who wish to downsize. Not all of them wish to reside in condos in the Pearl or South Waterfront, so where do they go? Vancouver? Any constraint on supply not only puts upward pressure on prices, but also hurts the economic fabric of the city. Impacts include loss of revenue to local businesses as people move away, less jobs for the construction industry, and lost revenue to the suppliers of products and services to these workers. Additionally, there will be a loss of revenue and the decrease of property taxes that fund services for the entire state. Other unintended consequences, sellers receiving $25,000 less for their homes because developers will argue to homeowners that this proposal just devalued their home. Another consequence will simply be an increase in home prices. Developers will just simply pass this additional cost on to the consumer. It does not seem logical that if one buys a single home on a 10,000-square-foot lot and because of zoning is allowed to build anywhere from 4 to 10 new homes, thereby adding more to the supply side, that they should be taxed on this. We as Oregonians value our farm and forest land and do not wish to see our urban growth boundary expand to levels that would create unfettered growth. The city claims that one of the most critical livability goals is to increase density. If density is the goal and prices are already high and supply is low, why is the council considering placing yet another constraint on infill and applying more upward pressure on home prices? I realize people are angry and that a number of older homes have been torn down that could have been saved, but do not allow the outlier to become the norm and the basis for this proposal. In closing, and I speak for many who could not be here today, I must take issue with the City Council selecting the day before a large traditional holiday as the scheduled time for this important public hearing. It is disingenuous engagement. Though I have no doubt that this proposal was initially well-intended, it is ill-conceived, will fail on many fronts, and will not bring the desired results. This is a critical issue, one that deserves far more discussion and redesign. Thanks.
I just want to make sure you understand this tax would not apply to a situation.
R1, R2.5?
No.
No, just
so R. Like the great project you built in my neighborhood, mixed use over retail, that's
yeah, that's that's
untouched,
commercial zoning, though.
Untouched by this tax.
So what about underlying tax lots?
Single-family zones is what we're talking about. So single-family zones, R5, R7, R10.
Okay.
So not R2.5, not R1.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. Sorry.
But I don't think it applies. 2.5. Sorry, it does apply to 2.5.
It does apply to 2.5.
It does apply to 2.5. So
but not 1 or 2.
Not R1, not R2. Those are multifamily zones for now.
So
they're about to
2.5.
Be replaced by mixed-use zones. I mean, that project you built in my
right.
neighborhood would be in our new zoning code.
But it's still, but
it would be a mixed-use zone.
I understand. But in R2.5, if it's a 10,000-square-foot lot, you're still adding 4 units.
Potentially, yes.
So do you support the money that going into a dedicated fund with
yes.
the Housing Investment Fund?
Absolutely.
And by the way, we're not taking a vote today. So
yeah, we're not voting today.
This, I think, is the second or third hearing we've had on this issue, so I just want you to know.
No, I've been here.
Thank you.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is John Medernuski. I'm here representing a local architecture firm and a client in particular. I have a couple kind of clarification items. So we have a project that has been delayed for a while. And we got approval for demolition of.
What's the firm you represent?
Oh, William Tripp, architect, small residential firm. The project's been delayed. We have the demo permit. It's since expired. So we're wondering if the client isn't able to start construction before February 1st or March 1st, whenever the start date is. Would we be okay with the demo permit that has been issued previously, or would we need to reapply again and have a current standing permit at the start time?
I believe the answer, we'll get that answer, but I believe you'd have to reapply, yes.
Okay, so it would have to be an active permit, okay. And then we have 2 dwelling units on our site, on one site, so I think that's been brought up earlier. You know, if that would be 25,000 or 50,000.
As it's currently proposed, the tax would apply to each house demolished. So,
okay.
So it would apply to each unit demolished, not to each unit built.
Okay,
so,
gotcha. So it would be 50,000 in our case. Okay. And then the last thing, we had a lot of talk about a lot of numbers and taxes and all that. But I was wondering if there's ever been mention of like a more of a human element. If you're applying for your demo permit, if you can say, you know, here's what we're doing and here's how it's going to benefit the neighborhood, is there some kind of panel who could review that and on a case-by-case basis give approval or denial?
No, we're not setting that up. No, yeah, I appreciate the suggestion, but that'd be pretty unwieldy for us. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Okay, let's take the next one.
Claire Carter, Terry Parker, Steve Smessler, Lightning. They'll be followed by Claire Carter, Diane Lynn, Peggy Moretti.
Morning, go ahead. Just push the button on the base of that microphone there.
Morning. My name's Steve Smelzer. I used to work with you, Jerry.
Yeah, good to see you, Steve.
Years ago. I'm a home builder. I've spent my whole career since 1970 building primarily affordable housing. It's what I do. Over those 40 years, 45 years of building homes, there's been all kinds of fees increase, systems development fees, rule changes, and I have yet to see one that has made housing more affordable. Every one of them, all they do is drive the cost of housing up. This fee will do exactly the same thing. Existing housing prices follow new construction housing prices. And if new housing construction prices go up, because I have to pay a $25,000 fee to tear a house down, existing housing prices will rise the same. That happens everywhere in the world, and that's what will happen. When I buy a house, and I have bought two in Portland and tore them down, nothing in the last 5 years, but I have in the past, and I didn't build million-dollar houses. There may be some million-dollar houses built, but I would bet most of them are not. But when I buy a house down, I've tore a house down that was not energy efficient. It was not structurally safe for earthquakes, and it was probably full of lead, which isn't safe for kids living in those homes. And we build a new house that's energy efficient, has all the latest energy efficient appliances, no lead, and it's engineered seismically to be safe in an earthquake time. That's what we do.
Anything else?
The last thing that I want to say is the city has blighted areas that builders, you want builders to come in and rebuild. To make it cost $25,000 extra to tear down a blighted house might be a disincentive to come in and do that. And those areas then remain blighted.
Thank you.
May I ask you a question? What would you say to those who say that presumably developers are already selling their new houses for as much as they possibly can and that they wouldn't be able to tack the $25,000 on top?
It'll have to add on top. I mean, builders aren't going to build houses and take a loss. I mean, they're going to get what they can get for the market. Just as the existing homeowner, when he sells his house, he gets what he can get. You know, they call builders greedy people and stuff, but every homeowner does the same thing. You know, they sell the house for what they can get.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good morning.
Terry Parker.
I'm a fourth-generation Portlander speaking as an individual today. Portland's single-family home neighborhoods are under attack. In addition to working-class neighborhoods being torn apart by proposed upzoning in the comp plan, throughout the city, livable single-family homes are being demolished at an alarming rate. The average cost of a new house that replaces a home torn down is 2.4 times more. Many of the homes being torn down are considered to be affordable starter homes, some of them fixer-uppers. Reducing the housing stock of these starter homes also reduces the opportunity for lower-income people to invest in a house and obtain some wealth through the equity of property ownership instead of just continuing to pay rent. Moreover, diversity within single-family home neighborhoods suffer when there is an absence of affordable starter homes. Most of the new replacement houses fall into the category of either a narrow skinny box or an out-of-scale monster house, monster box with a porch superglued on the front side. In most cases, the footprint of these new cookie-cutter boxes interrupt the backyard and or front yard ribbons of green that add quality of life in most single-family neighborhoods. Moreover, the unique historical qualities of neighborhood character and architecture that make Portland an appealing place to live is lost when the only new single-family home comes in the form of various size boxes. Much has been said about the Portland single-family home neighborhoods that have disappeared, including those where the Veterans Memorial Coliseum now stands and in areas that have been part of urban renewal. The city needs to preserve single-family housing stock we still have. It must be affordable to all levels of income, including families just starting out, the working class, and senior citizens on fixed income. Assessing a demolition tax is a good start to reduce the obscene number of demolitions taking place, but not the entire answer or complete solution to the problem. As an individual and as a member of the UNR Steering Committee, I fully support the implementation of the demolition tax, the amendment that eliminates the rebate for constructing two houses for one demolished home, and the testimony supplied by UNR. And I would also like to add one other thing, that I have a concern about the homeowner not paying the tax, because the homeowner could likely be scamming the system with the developer, joining forces with the developer. So I agree with Steve in this case, that or Commissioner Novak, that there needs to be some sort of policy that the homeowner must live in the home for a certain period of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. I think the ordinance should be adopted as amended, but I'm going to state my concerns is that I still think that $25,000 is too high. I'd like that to be reduced by 50%. And again, when the real estate brokers are doing a lot of business with the developers on building new homes and selling the homes, you real estate brokers can discount your fee and make up the difference on this issue, which will go to the Housing Investment Fund. Again, on the HIF, I don't want any limitations on where those funds can go. Of course, to affordable housing is the main priority. Another concern I have is people selling the houses in the neighborhoods. Why don't the neighborhood associations get together with them and say, why don't you put something in a covenant or something in an agreement that states you don't want this to be demolished, and only will sell it to somebody that wants to rehab the property? The sellers have that ability to do that, and if the neighborhood associations get together with them, why not implement that? What I don't want to see again is the developers restricted, impeded, and sent away, because we do need new houses being built, as the gentleman stated, for his family, and that's an option that should be out there. We should not restrict him from being able to look at those kind of houses. So again, from my position, I think this tax is too high, and the brokerage houses should step up also on the additional amount that should go to the HIF fund. And if they don't want to, don't deal with the developers. Just have the developers sell it out themselves, and let's just cut the brokers out of the deal at 100%. And maybe they'll understand that if they want to step up to the table today and say, hey, let's not let the developers build the houses, but hey, if they have a $1 million home they just did, then I want to get in there and get that commission. Well, that's kind of a double standard. So stand by what you say, and a lot of sellers out there, I think, would be open to not allowing the house that they are selling not to be demolished, but they also have to understand up front, you need to talk to your broker and have that put into some form of agreement, whether in the listing agreement or have an attorney draw something up to make sure that happens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lightning, can I just clarify something? Because
yes. It
just seems like there's still some lingering doubt on this proposition, and
sure.
I just want to once and for all clear this up. The current proposal before us that's already been amended states clearly that any revenue will go into the housing investment fund without any restrictions.
Okay, very good.
For any purpose the commissioner in charge wishes to spend it without restriction.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Okay, next three, please.
Next, please come up. Claire Carter, Diane Lynn, Peggy Moretti.
Good morning. Go ahead, Diane, while the others are getting
settled. All right. Good morning. Diane Lynn, Director at Proud Ground. Thank you so much. I'll try to be briefer than 2 minutes because I think I'm here to suggest that you're going in the right direction with this tax. It really could be, as Ruth said, from Oregon on, I join her voice in this effort to create yet another source, another tool in our extraordinary effort to deal with this crisis we have here in our wonderful city around affordable housing. No tax is ever going to be universally embraced by the community. We all know that. But tough choices have to be made. And I think this is a source that could be really an additional, very helpful tool for us. The only thing I would like to add briefly this morning is we really do need to start to plant the seeds of permanent affordability every chance we get. If this money could be applied, at least in some ways, it doesn't have to be exclusively applied. I appreciate Commissioner Fish's effort to expand our choices. We do need to talk about establishing permanently affordable housing. So 10 and 20 and 30 years down the road, we're not facing these similar issues over and over and over again in neighborhoods. So we're going to be working diligently with our partners at Habitat for Humanity, Proud Ground, to promote home ownership as a real opportunity for the use of these funds. How you amend this exact public policy, I give you the best of luck in finding the sweet spot. But please do support this tax so we can apply it to some very important investments in ideally home ownership and other affordability efforts in the city.
But just to your point, I think we should be more flexible in renewing our multi-program. If we can get an extra 10 years under the program, I think we should have an agreement with the county to do so. I think the 60-year affordability covenant generally that we require a number of our programs is about right. So that's, for me, the gold standard. And if Commissioner Saltzman decides that he wants to use a portion of the HIF to do land banking ahead of affordable home ownership within our community, I think that would be a splendid use of this money. The one thing we don't want to do, though, is start having sources that we put into this fund with strings attached. Then it becomes less the flexible tool that can be used for a whole array of purposes and more an accounting nightmare. So that's the only purpose behind keeping it unencumbered. But you seem to, I personally think that you have a number of compelling claims on that money for things around home ownership.
Can I just add, please, that the gold standard should be permanent affordability in a perfect world, together with all those other measures, the Holt and other exemption programs. Still, the price point is really too high for people making 60-70% of MFI in the community. So I'd add that point.
Good point. Thank you. Welcome. Good morning. Would you like to just push the button on the base of that microphone, then we can actually hear you? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Clara Carter. I live at 6156 Southwest Nevada Court, Portland. I'm here to testify as a DRAC representative about the proposed 25,000 demolition tax. The Development Review Advisory Committee for the Uninitiated is a council-appointed group of 17 individuals that include all sectors of building and development community within the city of Portland. We represent a broad array, including neighborhood coalition, land use committees, minority construction professionals, environmental conservation green building, low-income housing developers, public works permits, small businesses, citywide neighborhood interests, historic preservation, frequent development review customers, design professionals, large developers, large construction contractors, home builders, major facilities, landowners, home remodelers, Portland Planning Commission, and land use professionals. 17 people that represent the broad array of interests that are involved in development in the city of Portland. The DRAC first heard about this proposal at the September and at the September 17th meeting. We voted to submit a letter to the mayor's office expressing disappointment that there had been no involvement in this standing city committee in developing or reviewing the idea of a demolition tax. The DRAC met last Thursday at our regular meeting, November 19th. We had a full agenda, and it included Jillian Detweiler from the mayor's office. Thank you, Jillian, for showing up and talking to us about the demolition tax as it is currently proposed with one of Mayor Hales's amendments, but not the array of amendments that has been proposed this morning. Lively discussion followed. The DRAC voted unanimously to oppose the proposal, and we submitted a letter to the mayor's office stating our reasons. I have the letter. I don't know if you've all had the opportunity to... Okay, so I'm seeing nods. Okay, the opposition, I'll try to finish up. Opposition, as detailed in the letter, is based on four main concerns. The first is the proposal attempts to use the demolition tax as a one-size-fits-all response to many concerns expressed by neighborhoods and special interest groups, including developers. The larger issues that need to be addressed are housing affordability, planning efforts to increase residential density, loss of neighborhood landmarks, cohesiveness, character, and the need to replace substandard housing stock with safer code-compliant housing. The proposal does not directly address any one of these issues. Two, the process of developing the proposal was not inclusive and did not involve key stakeholders, including the development community. Since stakeholder involvement was limited, I suspect the proposal pleases none and offends all more than offering solutions. Three, the proposal will negatively impact housing affordability by adding $25,000 to the cost of housing built to replace demolished structures. That is a basic truth. You know, you can kind of try to tiptoe around it any way you want, but it's going to be $25,000 on top of the cost of housing. And fourth, the proposal was developed at least in part to address the demolition crisis. And I would say, having been on the inside of this issue for quite a while, is there really a demolition crisis? You know, we have numbers, but we don't really know what they mean. The analysis has been limited. Is the city really undergoing loss of housing that is higher than ever before? I don't know. You know, is this the crisis, really? You know, so the Development Review Advisory Committee really would like to see this proposal withdrawn, and we would like to see larger involvement of the community in crafting a proposal that meets the needs that are expressed. And what I've been hearing this morning is housing affordability in the city is a huge issue. The council needs to step up and needs to look at finding long-term solutions to this issue.
Thank you. Let me get you to wrap up.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate your attention to this important issue.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning. My name is Peggy Moretti. I'm the Executive Director of Restore Oregon, a nonprofit that works statewide to pass forward Oregon's historic places and promotes livable communities. I do want to take a second to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and express our thankfulness for your service to the city. We've been tracking the growing demolition epidemic, and we do believe it is an epidemic just by the escalating numbers that we have tracked. We've participated in several task forces and proposed practical solutions that will curb the demolitions going on while allowing for needed growth. Our staff is currently serving on the Residential Infill Project, the Deconstruction Advisory Group, have participated in DRAC conversations, and the Seismic Advisory Group. We support very strongly the proposed demolition tax for two primary reasons. It provides a very important disincentive to counterbalance what the accelerating market forces are doing to spur the 400-plus single-family residential demolitions that we will experience this year. We think this tax will slow the pace. It won't eliminate it, but it will slow the pace of demolitions, allowing the residential infill project to do its work.
to redefine the single-family zoning code in a way that will retain neighborhood character. The second reason we think this makes sense for the city is that the demolition tax aligns with our sustainability goals. Every time a building is demolished, we're throwing away tons of materials, craftsmanship, history, and the embodied energy that has already been expended. It should hurt to dump that much into the landfill. It has been well documented that it will take decades for a replacement structure to offset the energy thrown away and the energy expended in the new construction. Some have questioned whether it's appropriate to label what we're experiencing as a demolition epidemic. Commissioner Novak said that to me last week. But it does meet characteristics of an epidemic in that it is currently uncontrolled and that the fatalities, I would put quote marks around that, have a very permanent impact on the community. We think the money raised from the demolition tax will not of itself solve our affordability housing issues, but even if only half of the current 400 homes that are demolished end up paying that tax, that is $5 million towards this very important goal of affordable housing. And, of course, we hope some of that affordable housing will be created in historic buildings. The current situation is costing Portland a lot in the form of waste and landfill, loss of affordable starter homes, the release of hazardous materials, and the loss of neighborhood character that makes Portland, Portland. It may well make sense to revisit this tax in a few years, and we might even suggest some amendments that in the form of waiving the tax for a house move, a house that was relocated, and perhaps reduce it for deconstruction. But right now, the demolition tax offers an important and effective disincentive and gives our neighborhoods a fighting chance.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Okay.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. We have five more, and I'll call the first three, Michael Dowd, Cameron Harrington, and Paul Grove, and then they will be followed by Charles Johnson and Jane Leo.
Okay. Go ahead and take the, yeah, go ahead and take the center seat there. That we don't have to use that other microphone. Yeah, go.
I'm Mike Dowd. I'm an architect. I oppose this tax as proposed. I am sympathetic to neighbors of developers tearing down good houses and replacing them with incompatible spec houses. But this proposal needs exemptions to avoid punishing people like me due to the assumption that all demolitions are bad. Before saying anything else, I'd like to ask you to please exempt, again at a minimum, one, people who have lived in their homes for me it would work if you've lived there 10 years, I've lived in mine 10, and want to replace their own homes for themselves. And most importantly, number two, houses in flood zones, especially my Miles Street neighborhood. There's very few people in either of those categories, but it would be very unfair if those are not exempted. Please look at the photo on the last page of what I've submitted. That's my neighborhood in the 96 flood. Moving on, I wrote three lists in the testimony, seven reasons the tax is unfair, 10 situations that should always be exempted, and five things that should happen instead. I also added five situations that are ironically being ignored here. Please read those before voting. Today I'm here as a homeowner who definitely will lose $25,000 that I don't have unless you make exemptions. 10 years ago, I bought my house for my family with the goal of replacing it with my dream home. It's under 800 square feet, poorly designed, poorly constructed, in poor condition, and in a flood zone. It has no quality or integrity. Its problems cannot be solved through remodeling, even if the design and structure allowed feasible remodeling, which they don't. Flood regulations would trigger removing the entire basement, tearing out the foundation, building a new liquefaction-resistant foundation, raising the living spaces above flood level, and bringing the house up to current codes. My neighbors are in the same boat, or boats, if you don't exempt us. It's assessed far lower in its land and is only a quarter the size of the nice new homes nearby. In fact, if you read my list of 10 situations that should be exempt from this tax, my house meets every one of those. To protect our neighbors. Also, the zoning already requires that we go through greenway review and design review, so any new house will be compatible. I object to having my affordability knocked down by $25,000 that I don't have to punish us for a positive demolition to pay for someone else's affordability. Plus, since the home's value is almost entirely in the location, not the structure, I'll still be the one paying the tax if we sell it, because nobody is going to pay anything near what we paid unless they can tear it down. And since they'll need $25,000 for that, they'll offer that much less to us. Summary, 99% of homes in Portland can be added on to or remodeled. Don't punish me for being in the other 1%. We want to be left alone to achieve at our own expense what others in this room already enjoy. So please read and consider my exemptions, and thank you, Commissioner Fritz, for yours. If you did that one plus the flood exemption, I'd be happy.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Commissioners. My name is Cameron Harrington. I represent Living Cully, which is a collaborative effort of four community development organizations in the Cully neighborhood: Verde, NEA, Hacienda CDC, and Habitat for Humanity. Our first major concern, which we relayed to you in written communication, you've already taken care of, which was to add an exemption, an upfront exemption for demolitions that will result in affordable housing. I had a number of really impressive points I was going to make about that. I'll skip those since you've already taken care of that. Our second point is that...
By the way, I'm glad you did that. I still remember one of my favorite hearings at City Council on an issue involving the utilities, and prior to taking testimony, we adopted an amendment which cured the problem. But the person was so eager to go after one of my colleagues that he read his comments and attacked the person who had amended successfully with the matter, because he had to get it off his chest. And you might have guessed Commissioner Leonard was on the receiving end, but it was quite a moment. So I appreciate your...
I'll save you from that.
There were excellent points, though.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, they were. Appreciate it. So our second point is we strongly support the amendment to remove the rebate in cases where density is added. The intent of having that rebate in the first place, presumptively, would be to encourage increased density, which is a goal that we support. However, this rebate is completely unnecessary to achieve that goal. It is in situations where density could be added that demolition is most likely to take place already, because there is the highest profit margin to be made by the developer. So they're already going to do that, because that is how you maximize profits, is by knocking down one house and selling two or three or four. So we don't need to also give developers a $25,000 public subsidy to do the thing they were already going to do. That's just a misappropriation of public funds, and it also would limit the revenue brought in through this tax by 50%. The Oregonian reported that half of the demolitions that have occurred in the last 2 years have resulted in increased density, and we would be foregoing millions of dollars of revenue for the Housing Investment Fund if we leave that loophole in place, which, again, is a completely unnecessary loophole. And our third point is the ordinance needs to be clarified to make sure that this tax is being applied per unit that is demolished, not per structure. If there's a duplex or a quadplex, that needs to be really clarified. And in our communication with the mayor's staff, it sounds like that is still ambiguous.
No, the way I read it, if you look at the definitions, it says that residential structure means a dwelling unit.
Yeah, and I raised that question with the mayor's staff, and it would be great to really clarify that point as the administrative rules being put together. And we're also very concerned about potentially pushing back the deadline to March 1st without having some intermediate step to hold back on permits being pulled right now. We saw what happened when there was a lag time in the 90-day rent increase ordinance. I mean, I was one of those renters whose landlords took advantage of that lag time to jump in with a rent increase under the gun. So it shouldn't take 3 months to figure out how to implement this new rule.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Mayor Hales, commissioners, for the record, Paul Grove with the Home Builders of Portland, or that dreaded D word as Commissioner Novick referred to earlier. I've handed out my testimony. I won't read it. It's there for you to look at your convenience. It closely mirrors the testimony we submitted back in October with the added policy concern or consideration around the removal of the density rebate. Again, rather than go through my testimony point for point, I want to highlight some issues or items that we've heard and really focus on some consequences, frankly, unintended consequences that may be a result of the proposal before you. I think the first thing I want to highlight is the testimony that we've heard from economists on the issue around, does a $25,000 tax achieve the goal of dissuading a teardown and impact affordability, in particular the quote-unquote McMansions that folks have voiced concerns over? And we've heard previously in October the answer was no. Moreover, the economists stressed that the tax could result in a potential hardship for less affluent neighborhoods. I think it's something that council has to be mindful of moving forward with respect to this. The second thing I was going to note, but there's been a robust discussion today, is around those not-for-profit developers, the Habitats and others, building in and around the SDC waiver line, and I think whatever we can do to encourage their ability to move forward with those types of projects, the better. And we know it's a hardship for them to carry the cost of the tax and the additional financing. I think the same ultimately holds true for smaller builders that are building in and around the median home price as well. It's a very real consideration, and there are fewer and fewer that are building in that range. The third thing I wanted to note is, and you heard from previous testimony in October, the retired gentleman from North Portland, he and his neighbor were worried about the impact to their nest eggs. And similar to the cost of a home and the $25,000 being shifted to the purchase price, the same would hold true for that individual property owner. And the owner-occupied piece, really quickly, is very compelling testimony from the young pregnant woman, their couple looking to do a remodel, could not afford that, wanted to do a potential teardown and rebuild, but found the $25,000 prohibitive. The last thing I want to note, and you heard testimony today around middle-class, workforce-type housing, is very real consideration with respect to this tax. The last thing, with respect to the Home Builders Foundation, I know many of you are very familiar with the work that they do around transitional housing for women and children, and part of their model, as you know, involves the potential teardown of a home. And so I would ask council that for those not-for-profits, in addition to building around the SDC waiver line, that are on the front lines of the housing emergency, providing transitional shelters and other types of housing, that we don't have an unintended consequence or impact to the work that they're doing at the end of the day, because I think it would fly counter and negatively impact their work.
So I have a couple questions, and sure. I really appreciate your focus on affordability, and I actually share a number of the concerns that you raised that really relate to the zip code, where these are happening, and general affordability, and I appreciate your support for the exemption language on the nonprofit affordable homeownership. But maybe it's because we don't have a lot of great data that there's some confusion in this debate. But I'm just curious. I have anecdotal evidence about demolitions that are occurring in Northeast. And almost invariably, they're homes that once were affordable being replaced by homes that are now completely out of reach. And in fact, every demolition within three blocks of my house is a home that once upon a time a police officer and a nurse could afford, and now I don't know who is affording these homes that are coming in at $850,000, except people that have cash from the sale of their prior home and are taking advantage of historically low interest rates. Where in the city are you seeing evidence of demolitions where homes are being replaced by developers with homes that are affordable to police officers and nurses? Because Randy Sebastian was in here, and I appreciated his candor. He's a prominent developer, and he's in the forefront of these demolitions, and he's building $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 homes. And God bless him if he can find someone to buy those. Where are we seeing demolitions leading to replacement homes that are affordable for cops and nurses?
Well, Commissioner Fisher, I appreciate the question. I'll give you one quick example that comes to the top of my head. I know that Mayor Hales has seen the complex. We did a tour, and the mayor graciously provided a lot of his time one day, and we could show a variety of different homes. One of the projects that we showed him was a teardown, I believe, around Southeast 77th, and it was one home torn down, replaced with cottage cluster development, six new homes, all around the $335 price range. So I think that would be an example that immediately comes to mind of a teardown replaced with increased density at a very affordable price point.
So
there are those out there. Now, if for increased data, I mean, I can, you know, certainly try.
Are they the exceptions or the rule?
I don't have an answer for you at the moment.
I think the data, actually, we've got the data line by line for, you know, all the last 3 years, and the data shows that's the exception. It's a wonderful exception. But as I mentioned earlier, the average difference in price is $300,000 between the purchase price and the sale house, the for sale house. That's the difference. That's just the delta. That's not the underlying base. So it's a wonderful exception, but it's an exception.
Well, and so I guess it goes to the point, though, because we have, and I have my share of qualms with this proposal. I'm not trying to mislead you here, but it does seem that we use a very elastic definition of what's affordable housing sometimes in these debates. And I guess I'll put it to you I'm interested just from a policy point of view. Does imposing an additional $25,000 on a transaction where the house is going to be sold for between $700,000 and $1 million, does that work against any definition of affordable housing goals in our city? You may disagree with the policy, you may disagree with the tool, but is there any conceivable affordable housing goal of the city that offends?
Well, Commissioner Fish, I think
particularly because we've been preempted from other tools we might think are more strategic, and some of our greatest critics have prevented us from using other tools, which in my mind are actually better tools for a number of reasons. But our hands are tied because they have more influence in Salem than we do. So on this one, does it offend an affordable housing goal to add $25,000 if truly is a pass-through to someone buying a house between $700,000 and $1 million?
Well, I would suggest, Commissioner Fish, that the issue can be looked at in two lenses. You're talking about housing affordability and affordable housing. And so if it's an affordable housing goal, and does $25,000 offend the notion? I apologize, I'm not quite understanding.
If one of your members who's thinking about tearing down a house and building a bigger house decides to add $25,000, see if they can collect an additional $25,000, in other words, pass this cost through. And in my neighborhood, by the way, people are strategically listing prices at a ridiculous number, and then there's a bidding war that goes above that. So that we're in an uncharted territory in terms of what people are willing to pay, apparently, at this high end. Does it offend any affordable housing goals that I know the foundation cares about and we work on? Add $25,000 to the cost of a house that's otherwise going to be selling for $700,000 to $1 million.
I'm struggling with the question. I apologize, and then maybe that's just me in the moment, not quite, you know, getting my arms around it. But the $25,000 path through to support the program or the policy objective that we're talking about today. I mean, or
I guess maybe I'm. It's the end of a long month. We all have council hangover for the big rush to get everything done this year. But you make a compelling argument to me when you're talking about at the lower end of the housing market.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I'm not seeing many examples of demolitions where developers are replacing $300,000 bungalows with $325,000 bungalows that are affordable. And so what we're seeing is, and the data suggests, is we're seeing a huge bump up in price, and people therefore are building bigger homes, and they're serving a different market. And I'm not here to question the market, but I'm just wondering, since the argument that is used against this is somehow, even at the high end, it works against affordability, I just want to question that, because at between $700,000 and $1 million, I'm not sure I'm not sure the conversation should be framed around affordability, because already people demonstrated they have the resources to buy a very substantial house, and I'm not sure it makes a big difference.
Sure, I apologize for just, you know, struggling on the spot with the question. I think, one, with respect to the data, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I'm not, you know, going to question what the mayor and others have in front of them, but I would like to ultimately follow up and see what that looks like. Two, as to...
Actually, Mr. Grove, can I throw something out here? Sure. My staff informs me that the average value of the replacement home in the past couple of years has been around $500,000, so that suggests that greater than $35,000 is unusual, but that $700,000 isn't always what it is either.
And so then to the other piece around the, you know, the large-scale homes and the issues around affordability, and is this counter, I guess, to the affordability objectives. And again, I think you hit upon an important point, though, oftentimes in terms of what the market is going to dictate with some of these new homes that are being built. But I would also suggest, though, that what is more affordable, two homes at $425,000 or one home at $850,000. And I think, you know, there are certainly instances where you have two homes at $425,000, and to me that is a much more affordable proposition at the end of the day.
So and I get that, and you therefore disagree with the mayor's amendment to take that density piece out, and that's clear. Well, at some point, because the home builders have worked with us on lots of affordable housing initiatives, your foundation does amazing work, I'd be interested in continuing this discussion around things we can support together. And I appreciate that this is a tool that you don't support. And I'd be interested in what tools we could support. And again, most of them seem to be preempted by the state legislature. And I'd love to find something that you and I could together go to Salem and agree as a tool that we should use for affordable housing.
Thank you very much.
Actually, Mayor, I've got a couple more questions. One is, how often do you see a demolition resulting in more density in single-family zones, which is all we're talking about here?
Yeah, Commissioner Novick, we had some data pulled for 2015, and this is older data. It's around end of September, early October. What we had seen, and these were where development was planned and identified, and we saw 165 teardowns replaced with approximately, I want to say, just under 300 new homes. So I think that's about 175-180% increase at the end of the day. So if that gets to your question.
Other question is a little off topic, but the issue of asbestos. I mean, I too have been concerned, as one of the previous testifiers said, concerned by the Oregonians reporting that it sounds like DEQ isn't doing a very good job enforcing the asbestos regulations. And I'd appreciate, maybe not today, but at some point, if you have any suggestions as to what the city could do to protect people from asbestos while the state's trying to improve what they're doing.
Certainly happy to follow up.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Okay, let's click the last two, and then we'll call staff back up.
Charles Johnson and Jane Leo.
Come on up.
Jane, when was the last time you batted cleanup?
I know, it's all about me. Did you see what your pressure? Yeah. No, it's about
she wants to back clean up. Go ahead, Charles.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Charles Johnson, and I just want to slightly quote Mr. Commissioner Fitz, Commissioner Fish, but then take it out of context. He said he was not going to question the market. Markets give us cool stuff. Markets also give us child labor, pollution, worker deaths. So I know Commissioner Fish will, in the right context, question the market, even if it's just real estate, because the real estate market is seen in the Journal of Commerce, and it's seen when you walk down Fifth Avenue in New York, and now Fifth Avenue Southwest in Portland look the same. They're full of buildings that have homeless people sleeping in front of them. That's a small part of the affordable housing thing. I know we have some things coming online, hopefully tonight and tomorrow night, to start addressing that problem. But I'm not sure how much honesty and candor has been in some of this testimony. We know that there are, well, first of all, there's no progressive taxation at all when it comes to real estate speculation. So those people already have a huge pass. So this, primarily I want to tell you, pass this. Get it on the books. then listen to the people, and you'll find that the tweaks that are much more important are going to be to make it progressive and deterrent at the high end. Yes, there might be some small anecdotal stories of small homeowners who had some problems. I have confidence in y'all that you can properly interpret the legislative intent for this and that small homeowners won't be hurt. Small homes will stay available and on the market at an entry level, and you can adjust this so that when somebody buys a $200,000 home and demolishes it and replaces it with something that comes